I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just go to our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and you'll see the link to becoming a Patreon member in the upper right-hand corner. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we do not have a guest, sorry. But we are going to read some articles from the early 1980s. I was looking through some old Muscle Mag Internationals. I know I get a lot of requests from you guys for training articles. We talk a lot about profile pieces and also contest reports. But it's good once in a while to read about the training routines that a lot of these bodybuilders followed. And Muscle Mag International, as many of you know, was kind of an independent magazine. Of course, Joe Weider's magazine only promoted the IFBB. But Muscle Mag was a little bit different. They were independent. They covered everything. They covered the IFBB. They covered the AAU. They covered Dan Lorry's organization, the WBBG, and they covered NABBA. The 1980s was a little bit different because they had so many different organizations, and every once in a while, you get some really great bodybuilders coming out of these organizations, and it was kind of funny because Joe Weider's magazine would basically ignore these guys like they didn't exist, while the rest of the bodybuilding world clearly knew they were around, and they were very, very impressive. One of those guys, of course, was Bertel Fox. And Bertel Fox was from England, so he started off competing in the NABBA Mr. Universe, which he won several times. And then he finally made his way over to California, and he joined the IFBB eventually. But in the beginning, in the early 1980s, Joe Weider was basically, just like I said, ignoring him. So if it wasn't for Muscle Mag International and Bob Kennedy, we would not really have seen pictures or seen the training articles of Bertel Fox. So this first article I'm going to read today comes from the November 1981 issue of Muscle Mag, where they have a training routine of Bertel Fox, which was pretty impressive because he was so extremely strong, especially for back then. And then in the January 1982 issue, there was an article about Sergio Oliva and how he trains. And this is going to be interesting as well, because Sergio at the time was sort of banned from the IFBB. His last IFBB contest was 1973 when he won the IFBB Mr. International contest in Tijuana, Mexico. So this is almost 10 years later. And in that time, Sergio had competed only in the WBBG show and also Surgeon Braid's organization, WABA. So in the early 1980s, Sergio was kind of making a comeback. During the late 70s, he really was not in his best shape. He would show up at a lot of these contests fat and out of shape, and he would usually win because of his name, because of, he was Sergio, and he was considered the myth. But in 1980 and 81, Sergio really got into amazing shape. He looked fantastic. Some of the best condition he ever had in his whole career, really. And he was pretty much older at this time, but he really looked fantastic. And then he finally did go back to the IFBB in 1984, but by that time, he was kind of past his peak. So it'll be interesting to read this article, which was written by Chris Lund, and this is from the January 1982 issue. So this is when Sergio was really at his best. I get a lot of emails about Serge Dubray. People are really fascinated with him. So we have another article about how Serge Dubray trains, and this is also written by Chris Lund, and this is from the September 1982 issue. And then finally, I've got one about Albert Beckles, and Albert was another unique case. He had been around a long time. He started competing in the 1960s. He's originally from Barbados, but he moved over to England during the 1960s, and then he was competing there. And living in England, of course, he was competing in the NABBA Universe. He won the Mr. Britain, and then he won the NABBA Universe, and he was over there. And then he started competing in the IFBB, and he did pretty good. He won the 1971 IFBB Mr. Universe, and then he kind of went through a down period. I would say like the late 1970s, Albert just wasn't in the same shape he used to be in, and it kind of looked like his career was over. And then in the early 1980s, he had a revival, and he started coming in very hard condition, very ripped, and he was in his late 40s, early 50s by this time. So it was amazing. So there's another article I want to read about Albert and about his training. All right. Before we get to that, I want to wish Ronnie Coleman a happy birthday today. Ronnie was born on May 13th, and he is 60 years old today. So happy birthday to one of the GOATs, Ronnie Coleman. Well, of course, a lot of people believe Lee Haney is the GOAT, and a lot of people believe Arnold Schwarzenegger is the GOAT. But Ronnie, 8-time Mr. Olympia, definitely deserves to be in that discussion. Incredible bodybuilder, incredible inspiration to so many people, even today, all these years after he retired. And Ronnie is now 60 years old. Of course, we know he's not in the greatest of health. He's walking with a walker. He really can't even stand on his own. A lot of surgeries he's had on his back, on his neck, on his hips. But he's always smiling, and he's always pushing through. You know, you always see Ronnie at all the big contests, always making appearances, and people are still inspired by him to this day. So happy birthday, Ronnie. I hope he has a great day. Last weekend, they had the big guest posing out in Pittsburgh that they do every year. This is Jim Mannion's show. It's a Pittsburgh pro competition. I think they had the pro classic physique, and they also had, I think, bikini competition. So they had several pro competitions. But the big event is when they get the top bodybuilders from the world to all come up on stage and guest pose. And this is about 5 months out from the Mr. Olympia. So, of course, these guys look monstrous. They're absolutely huge. So they had Derek Lunsford, who is from Tampa, Florida, where I'm from. Derek is the current Mr. Olympia. He is the reigning Mr. Olympia. He looked very impressive, extremely big. This guy is, I don't know how much he weighs, but I think he's only about 5'6". He looks like he's about 260. It's just huge, absolutely huge. And they also had Hunter Labrada, Lee Labrada's son. He was up there. I think he's about 300 pounds. Andrew Jack, who is a promising new bodybuilder. He was also off-season, very, very big guy. I love this guy's physique. I think he's got one of the best physiques in the pro scene because he's very aesthetic and he's a great poser, but a massive, massive guy, incredible body. So it'll be really interesting to see what he looks like this year. And then they had Nick Walker up there as well, and Nick is getting ready for the New York Pro, which is going to be next week. And, of course, Nick could not compete in the Olympia last year because he had a hamstring injury. So, unfortunately, he had to drop out, I think, only days before the contest. So that was very disappointing. So this is his comeback. There's a lot of varied opinions on how he looked. I was not really impressed with how he looked. I think his stomach is getting way too big. These guys just push the size so much that they're really forgetting about the symmetry of the body. But I guess that's the way it is today in the days of modern bodybuilding, right? So this is just the way it is. But, yeah, I was not too impressed with Nick. I think he looks better when he is a little bit lighter and when he can really keep that stomach in. So this is what happens when you start pushing that size game too much. But anyways, we'll see how he does this week. I'm sure he will win. He is favored heavily to win the contest. And of course, they want to see him back in the Mr. Olympia. So we'll see what happens this weekend. In other news, I did put up a couple of videos on my YouTube channel. I did a bodybuilding history segment that I've not done in about a year. I look back, I could not believe that I have not done a bodybuilding history video in so long. So I decided to do another one. This one is about the 1970 AAU Mr. America that Chris Dickerson won. And Casey Viator was in third place at only 18 years old. So I put that together. It's getting a lot of views. So check that out on my YouTube channel. And I also put up an interview I did with David Hawk. Now, this was on the podcast about 2 years ago in 2022, but I never got around to doing all the editing and adding all the contest clips and the pictures and all that. So I finally got around to doing that. So that's a two-part interview with David Hawk. That is also on my YouTube channel. So if you want to check that out, just go to my YouTube channel under my name, John Hansen, and you'll see all that up there. All right, guys. So let's get to these articles. So this first one, as I mentioned, comes from the November 1981 issue of Muscle Mag International. It is written by Chris Lund, who was a famous photographer from England. And it's about Bertel Fox. And it says, it's a fact, the world's greatest physique, Foxy. On seeing this layout, writer Chris Lund reminded us that whereas he feels Fox is a superstar in the physique world, he is equally impressed by Mike Mentzer's physique and would dearly love to see these two bodybuilders competing against each other in the not-too-distant future. Since the evolution of modern-day bodybuilding, we have always had an undisputed world's greatest physique champion, someone we could idolize. First, we had John Grimmick, then Steve Reeves, Reg Park, Bill Pearl, Larry Scott, Sergio Oliva, the great Arnold S., and Frank Zane. Although there were also many other great bodybuilders as well as these, it was the above-mentioned men who earned the title of World's Greatest Physique. These were the guys who set the trends and had the fans literally eating out of their hands. It's a fact that bodybuilding today has never had it so good in terms of publicity, interest, and most important, the highest standard of muscular competition ever. So why haven't we got a World's Greatest Physique today? Sure, we have Chris Dickerson, Mike Mentzer, Boyer Coe, Robbie Robinson, Dennis Tenorino, Roy Callender, Casey Viator, and Frank Zane, but can we all come to the same conclusion and say that either Zane is the greatest or Mentzer is the greatest, just as we could in the day of Arnold or Sergio, etc.? The answer is no, we can't. Ask 10 different bodybuilders the same question, and I'm sure you'll get five or more different answers. One reason we can't come to a concrete and similar agreement is because there are more great bodybuilders in the world today than there's ever been. And as they are more or less equal in their greatness, it becomes virtually impossible to choose the greatest. There is, in my opinion, one man who could reign supreme over all his contemporaries and once again set the trend for the greatest physique in the world. That man is Britain's Bertel Fox. Having had the privilege and good fortune to have either seen or photographed almost all the world's greatest physiques during the last 10 years, I can safely say that I believe Foxy is the greatest of them all. So why doesn't he compete against these champions and prove it? There are several answers to that question, and I hope to maybe try to answer some of them during the course of this article. I first met Bertel Fox personally at a small contest just 2 weeks prior to the 1978 NABBA Pro Mr. Universe in London, England. He had been booked to guest pose at this show, and as the universe was only 2 weeks away, I felt certain he would be in fantastic shape, because he would be taking on the great Serge Nubre, who I knew was in the best condition of his life. I traveled to the contest earlier than usual so I could set up a temporary photographic studio. I wanted to capture Bertel on film and show the world the greatest physique in the world. Hello, Bertel. My name is Chris Lund, the photographer. I was wondering if, and before I could finish, Bertel interrupted with, "Oh, yes, I've read some of your articles." "Yeah, thank you very much. That's what I was about to talk to you about. You see, I brought all this equipment with me, and I was wondering if maybe I could shoot some color transparencies and maybe do a story on you for the Muscle Mags. I've never really seen many good shots of you. I know you must be in terrific shape with the universe only 2 weeks away," I quickly replied. "Well, I don't think so, you know," he said. "Why not? I'll give you a copy of everything I shoot," I desperately replied. "Well, I don't know. Maybe after I pose. See me then," he replied. I was right. Bertel was in sensational shape. In fact, the capacity crowd of almost 600 people went wild, and he was called back for an encore after encore. As he made his way back to the dressing room, I quickly collared him and once again made my plea. "Will you let me photograph you now?" "Well, not right now, you know. I feel a bit tired," he replied. Knowing that Foxy doesn't like too much attention, I quickly countered with, "Look, I've got the room to myself. It'll only take a few minutes, and I'm sure we can get some really great shots." "Oh, all right then, but make it quick," he replied. I should point out that quick is never the way to shoot really great photographs, but under the circumstances, well, anything would do. Having the camera and lights already set up, I eagerly positioned the great one onto the background. With everything looked right, I noticed I had one black and white shot left in the camera, so I said to Foxy, "Look, I got one black and white shot left in. Let's use it up, and then I'll put in some color, okay?" Bertel raised his great arm upwards and immediately hit the most amazing one-arm bicep pose I've ever seen. I shot the pose and declared, "That's great, but why not smile? You have a terrific smile, and it would make the shots look so much better." Bertel didn't reply, so with the word quick still planted in the back of my mind, I set about slipping in a roll of color film into the back of the camera. Within seconds, Foxy was off the backdrop like a flash of lightning and very hastily making his way towards the door. "Hey, what's up with you then?" I asked. "I'm sorry, but that's it. I gotta go," he called back, and then vanished through the adjoining door. "That's it. That's it. One poxy shot?" I almost cried. "All that trouble for one lousy shot? You got a crap job, Chris," declared Ron Davies, the 1978 senior Mr. Britain who'd been watching the proceedings. I think you're bloody right," I replied, miserably packing up all my equipment for the long journey home. It's now history that Bertel won the 1978 NABBA Professional Mr. Universe contest in London, beating contest favorite Serge Nubre, who incidentally was in the best shape of his life. I'd been told by twice Mr. Britain winner Eddie McDonoghue that Bertel had consented to pose for me at this contest. "I told him you're all right," said Eddie in his strong Liverpudlian accent. So with that boost of confidence and recommendation from Eddie, I gathered up the studio equipment, crammed it into the car, and headed for London. This time, I would capture the Fox. It's customary after the Friday afternoon judging's over for the best pro bodybuilders to be photographed in a small room backstage. Although Serge Nubre must have known he had been beaten, he gracefully consented to be photographed with the new young king of bodybuilding. After these two had been photographed together, I asked them if they wouldn't mind being shot individually. Serge agreed and remained on the backdrop while Bertel went into the next room. Not wanting to keep Foxy waiting too long, I quickly knocked off some shots of Serge. It doesn't surprise me now, but it shocked me then to discover that Foxy had once again performed his amazing disappearing act. The next time I saw Bertel was at the first bodybuilding seminar organized by gym owner Jim Charles in the lovely town of Stourbridge near Birmingham. It was about 6 months after his first Pro Mr. Universe win, and I was really looking forward to seeing him again. After his triumphant Universe win, all kinds of rumors had spread through the bodybuilding grapevine that the Great Fox was going over to Joe Weider at last. But alas, this was not to be. About 3 hours before the seminar, Bertel and I had a good chance to talk, and he immediately said he was sorry about the photo sessions. You see, I have all these people offering me contracts, and I just don't want to mess things up. Joe Weider wants me to go to California. A guy called Possing has asked me to go to Europe, and Peter Fasching wants me to join him in Germany. I just don't know what to do for the best, said Bertel desperately. Well, as far as I see it, and I don't want to influence you, but you really only have one answer to that problem, I said wryly. What's that? Bertel eagerly replied. Go to bloody California and Joe Weider, I snapped. Yeah, I know, but these other offers look pretty good, man, he said. Yes, I'm sure they are, but Europe is not big enough for you. You could do a star spot or seminar every single week of the year and still not do every town or city in America. Besides, just think of the publicity you'd get through Weider's magazine. Remember, nobody has ever made it big without publicity. Reeves, Scott, Oliva, Arnold, Robbie, Zane, Coe, and Menser have all become literally superstars through exposure and muscle builder, I said. Yeah, it does sound very tempting, but I just don't want to be ripped off, man, he replied. Well, okay, that's just a chance you'll have to take, I'm afraid, I replied. During the course of our long conversation, Bertel's true character and personality slowly but surely began coming across. The main thing that impressed me that morning was his search for truth, honesty, and fairness. In this day of exaggerated bullshit and downright dishonesty, all Bertel really wanted was a straightforward, honest-to-goodness, fair crack of the whip. He had no desire for the rich, fast life either. All I want, man, is to earn fair money for my physique and then settle down with a wife and kids and maybe open up a gym. The seminar Bertel gave that day was easily the best I've ever attended. Sparing nothing in an effort to give the fans what they asked for, Bertel proved also to be quite an entertainer, displaying a terrific sense of humor. During the interval, Bertel proceeded to sell his t-shirts, and I was amazed to see him wearing a leather jacket over the top of his own tee, completely blocking out that amazing physique. Take your jacket off, Bertel. When they see those arms, they'll buy the whole lot, I pleaded. Nah, I don't care for that showing off kind of crap, man. Bertel Fox easily won the 1979 NABBA Professional Mr. Universe title. In fact, he was so far ahead that they didn't even have a pose down between him and runner-up Dave Johns. Once again, I drove to London, squashed in between cameras, tripod, electronic lighting equipment, and a huge backdrop. I failed miserably to catch Bertel after Friday's judging was over. He just went missing again. At the theater the next day, I had to clear out a scruffy-looking storeroom in order to set up a makeshift studio in order to shoot the winners and their trophies. I had no trouble at all with the various height class winners, and I was able to shoot some really nice pictures. All through the show, I was simply dreading the finish. I knew that Bertel was an easy winner, and I felt I didn't have a hope in hell of getting some shots of him afterwards. Although I hadn't been told the results, I felt that Anulu had easily won the amateur title, and knowing only too well how temperamental he could be, I felt I was just wasting my time even bothering. As usual, chaos broke loose backstage as official and unofficial photographers snapped and flashed their Nikons and brownies at the three winners, Ahmet Anulu, Karen Griffin, and Bertel Fox. Karen had already consented to come back to the room to be photographed, so all I had to do now was pluck up the courage and ask Anulu the same question. Even as I approached him, he began shaking his head from left to right and back again, which means a great big no in any language. Ahmet is feeling very tired now and would like to rest, his interpreter sternly informed me. Bloody ridiculous, I thought. They're in the finest shape of their lives, and they can't even be bothered to show the world how great they looked on the day. Bertel, who was now trying desperately to stuff the two beautiful cut glass trophies into his training bag, looked up at me. So I impulsively said, "Well, I don't suppose you'll come back to be photographed. I got everything set up." "All right, let's go then," he replied. "What? Well, right," I stammered. The three of us then went back to the room, and for the next half hour, I took as many shots of them as I could. Needless to say, Bertel looked fabulous under the studio lights. As he went from pose to pose, the sight of those huge biceps as he squeezed and tensed them brought oohs and ahs from the people squeezing in for a look behind me. Bertel Fox was probably a lot luckier than most other young guys who take up bodybuilding. Of course, he was naturally built with tremendous potential, which would eventually be capable of building a truly sensational physique. But he was also coached into training properly right from the very beginning. His coach and training partner in those days was a guy named Henry Greaves, who had a terrific physique and 19-inch arms. Although at this time, Bertel was only 15 years old, he trained with this great bodybuilding champion, hardly ever missing a workout. Henry Greaves instilled in Bertel the dedicated way of life required to build a really super physique. While those of us argued and read about which was the best training method, Bertel and Henry were training four nights a week on a split routine using very basic exercises, lots of sets, loads of weight, and a hell of a lot of sweat. When Bertel first started training, he had the following measurements. His weight was 160 pounds, chest 37 inches, thighs 19 inches, calves 13 and a half inches, and arms 12 and a half inches. 2 years later, his arm measured an amazing 18 and a half inches. Here's the routine he followed to gain those 6 inches. Training his biceps and triceps twice a week, Bertel did three different supersets for them. His first superset was preacher curls using a straight bar and tricep pulley pushdowns using a straight bar and narrow grip. The curls were done for 6 sets of 8 reps and the pushdowns for 6 sets of 10 reps. His second superset was standing alternate dumbbell curls and very close grip tricep pushdowns with his upper body bent forward to a 45-degree angle. Once again, the curls were done for 6 sets of 8 reps and the tricep exercises for 6 sets of 10 reps. Bertel's last superset consisted of one-arm curls on an incline bench, his favorite exercise, and dumbbell tricep kickbacks laying face down on a 45-degree angle bench. The curls and kickbacks were each done for 6 sets of 8 reps. As Bertel would say, nothing fancy, just good old basic stuff with lots of weight. Amazingly enough, over 10 years later, Bertel's arm routine has hardly changed at all. Here's how he trains them today. Preacher curls and tricep pushdowns, incline dumbbell curls, 5 supersets with lying tricep extensions, 8 to 10 reps. One-arm dumbbell curls on an incline bench. Very close grip pushdowns, body bent forward to a 45 degree. Parallel bar dips, 4 trisets of 8 to 10 reps. Bertel usually trains year-round. When he's not training for a contest, he trains 4 to 5 nights a week on a split routine, so every body part is covered at least twice a week. Bertel likes to train his deltoids just before his arms every Monday and Thursday. Here's how he trains them. Heavy seated press behind the neck on a 90-degree angle bench, 5 sets of 8 reps working up in weight each set. Upright rowing, 5 sets of 8 reps working up in weight each set. Dumbbell side laterals, 5 sets of 8 reps. On Tuesday and Friday, Bertel trains his legs, chest, and back as follows. Heavy squats for legs, 5 sets working up in weight each set. Hack squats, 5 supersets with leg extensions, 8 to 10 reps. And then leg curls, 5 sets of 8 to 10 reps. Calves, seated calf raise, 5 sets of 20 reps. Standing calf raise, 6 sets of 20 reps. Chest, flat dumbbell bench press, very heavy, 6 sets of 10 reps. Incline barbell press, 5 sets of 8 to 10 reps, working up in weight each set. Incline dumbbell flies, and parallel bar dips with added weight, 5 supersets, 10 reps. For back, one-arm dumbbell rowing, 5 sets of 10 reps. Behind the neck, lat machine pulldowns, 5 sets of 10 reps. Close grip pulldowns to the waist, 4 sets of 10 reps. Chin-ups, 4 supersets of 10 reps with dumbbell pullovers. Not too surprising also is the fact that Bertel likes to eat a great deal in order to fuel himself through his very heavy workouts. On top of his list is liver, meat, tuna fish, and eggs, as many as 20 eggs a day. He has a favorite protein drink that he mixes twice a day, The drink consists of protein powder, cottage cheese, yogurt, and 12 eggs. He takes one of these drinks to work with him and has another during his workout. Wow. Still undecided as to which way to turn, Bertel entered and lost the 1980 WABA Mr. World in Paris last November. Training as never before, Bertel came face-to-face with the immortal Sergio Oliva. Both men were in the best shape of their lives. They had to be. The choice could have gone either way, although Bertel was in far better muscular condition than Sergio. Bertel was very upset and disillusioned at the outcome, and who knows, maybe this experience will tempt him into heading out west for the long-awaited confrontation with the world's other great physiques. I sincerely hope he does, and then maybe once again, we can have our world's greatest physique. All right. Not too much training stuff in there, but that was a good article. I never read that before. Chris Lund. All right. January 1982 issue of Muscle Mag. Chris Lund has another article, and this one's about Sergio and says, "A Day with Sergio." "We'll never all get in," I said anxiously to the great Nubre. No. It's okay, I tell you," he replied. "But I'm not sure. You might damage it, you know? There's a hell of a lot of weight in there," I said. "Look, don't worry. It'll be all right, I tell you," he countered sternly. Trying to pack seven giant bodybuilders and a photographer in one Jaguar motor car seems crazy enough to me. But when you consider that one of these bodybuilders was the great Sergio Oliva himself, then that definitely qualifies you for being posted to the funny farm immediately. It was a couple days before the great WABA Mr. World contest in Paris, France, and Nubre was in a dash to get to the television studios so that Sergio could do a TV publicity thing for the show. "So how am I going to get in? There's no room," I said, scrutinizing the inside of his Jag over and over again. No one answered this time. Serge sat impatiently at the wheel, tapping his fingers, and next to him was Sergio, wedged against the top California bodybuilder, John Brown. In the back was Eduardo Coac, who won the amateur title, plus three other big, big bodybuilders I just couldn't put a name to. I was about to give up in sheer desperation when the friendly words of a Mexican-Spanish type origin said, "Hey, you give me the tripod, and I put the camera on these guys." "Okay, Sergio, thanks very much, mate," I said, and in a second, we were off. If you've ever driven a car in Paris, then I'm sure you'll agree with me when I say the French must be the worst drivers in the world. Serge Nubre was no exception, and as we bumped our way down the tiny little narrow streets of Paris, we just missed collision after collision at almost every single road junction. "You know, your Bertel Fox, he rings me every week, and he says, 'Please, Serge, tell them the contest will be fair.' And I tell him, 'Yes, yes, yes, the contest, it will be fair. But you better come in good, because that Sergio, he's looking fantastic,' Serge said as we drove along." "You got to believe that man," cried Sergio with a great big grin all over his face. And driving in Paris was frightening, then parking was an absolute nightmare. As we approached the great big television studios, there wasn't an inch of parking space available anywhere. In fact, when these guys park, they don't quite double park, they quadruple park. One car on each side of the road and another car on the pavement on either side of that. Suddenly, one of the parked cars flashed his reversing lights and began to move out of the parking space. As if by magic, the parking space became suddenly up for grabs as one car came out of the blue directly behind us and another straight in front of us. This wasn't going to bother Serge Nubre at all, and he quickly put his plan into action, which was to get his oversized Jag into the parking space that looked only big enough to hold a mini. We went back, then we went forward, then we went back again, all the time to the accompaniment of the incessant and unmelodic tones coming from the car in front and the one behind. "You'll never make it, Serge. The car's too bloody big," I yelled as my neck twisted to the right and then to the left each time we moved. "You are in Paris now, Chris. This is how we do it," said the great one. By this time, quite a large group of noisy gay Parisians, not the bent kind, had assembled to watch the proceedings. Amidst the by now almost deafening sound of the other two car horns, I began to slowly evaluate the situation. Was this great big car bulging to the seams with eight bodybuilders going to get into that tiny parking space without causing damage to any other vehicle on the road? Or were we all going to be arrested by the police for overloading, dangerous driving, and numerous other offenses I didn't even dare think about? Discretion being the greater part of valor, I decided to get out of that car as quick as I could. I wasn't the only one thinking this because I was followed immediately by one of the other bodybuilders from California who'd been sitting next to me in the back. Joining the rest of the observers on the other side of the road, I can now tell by the angry look on the new Bray's face that he was getting a little fed up with the situation and that he intended to put the end to it once and for all. Selecting reverse gear, the Jag now contained only six bodybuilders, drove straight at the car behind him. "Oh no, I don't believe this. He's going to bloody well ram the car," I said, closing my eyes in disbelief. Crash! I looked up, and right enough, Serge has rammed the car behind him. The maroon-colored automatic Jag now moved into drive, and yes, you guessed it, rammed the other car in front, right up the jack seat. "Hey, man, you should have taken a picture of that for the magazine," said the guy from California. "Yes, it's amazing, isn't it?" I replied, with my mouth still hanging open. I thought for a moment that Serge might have trouble with the two drivers of the cars, but I guess one look at Nubre and Oliva would be enough to scare anyone off. Amazingly, Serge did manage to get the car into the space, and with literally only a couple of inches to spare. "How's he going to get out?" I muttered to myself. I had seen Sergio Oliva on two previous occasions. Once when he was very narrowly beat by Bill Pearl at the 1971 London Mr. Universe, and again when he beat Tony Emmett at the very controversial 1977 WABA Mr. World Contest. Although I felt he had one of the most amazing and unique physiques of any single living being, any single living bodybuilder the world has ever known, I felt that he just couldn't get that little bit of extra polish needed to beat the top, amazingly muscular guys of today. So knowing too well that Sergio simply hates the diet, I was putting my money on Fox. After the TV thing, Sergio declared, "Hey man, I want to do a bit of the training now." And pretty soon we pulled up outside of Nubre's International Club just as it began to snow. Serge Nubre's gym is not a fancy chrome-plated health club just waiting to take your money off you. No, his gym is a bodybuilder's gym, and it was truly unbelievable to see so many Serge Nubre lookalikes slowly and meticulously repping out set after set of bench presses with fairly light weights. I've never seen anyone as wide as Sergio Oliva, and the navy blue tracksuit he wore that day for his workout must have been custom made for him. In fact, I got the impression from the many varied and different clothes he wore every time you saw him that he must surely have his own wardrobe and personal tailor here with him in France. As Bob Kennedy remarked later, when Sergio changes into a different outfit, he not only appears a completely different person, he actually takes over that personality too. For instance, when he arrived at Charles de Gaulle Airport, he was wearing his Navy Chicago Police uniform, and he actually assumed the role of a cop, i.e. dead serious and aloof. Yet when I saw him the following day, he wore the most unbelievable pure white, fluffy, woolly jacket, backed up with the most gold jewelry I've seen on anyone since Sammy Davis. Indeed, this particular rig displayed the jolly, carefree lover of life type, and sure enough, Sergio played the part to a T, for he sure loves life, does that Sergio. Inside Nubre's gym, Sergio got set to train. Being already in his tracksuit, he only had to place his red, white, and blue sweatband over his now completely bald head, and we were away. First on the agenda was calf work. Using only the standing calf machine and the seated calf machine, Sergio did at least 8 sets of both exercises for at least 20 reps a set. He raised his heels up as high as he could at the top of the movement, and then he lowered them as far as he could at the bottom. At first, I got the impression that he wasn't working too hard, and then I happened to glance over to the weight stack. He was using the entire weight stack, making it look like child's play. After calves, Sergio said he just wanted to do a little bit of back work just to keep in shape for the contest on Saturday. Using the old-fashioned pull-down behind the neck exercise, Sergio took the widest grip I've ever seen used on this exercise and commenced his first set. As I said, Sergio used an extremely wide grip on the bar, and he pulled it as low down his neck as he could. He did about 6 sets of 20 to 25 reps a set and worked to about 80% of true muscular failure. Following this, Sergio did another 6 sets of at least 20 reps on the close grip reverse pull down to the chest. Sergio had to really put out on these, and he worked them much harder than the aforementioned pull downs. Resting only a few minutes, Sergio then said he wanted to pump up his shoulders a bit. "Great, pump up mine while you're about it," I thought to myself. Indeed, it's my own personal opinion that Sergio's greatest body part is his deltoids, even though nearly everyone else would probably say it's his arms. When Sergio Oliva spreads himself out to do a double bicep pose to the front or the rear, no one, repeat, no one can stand next to him. He is the biggest and widest bodybuilder the world has ever seen and maybe will ever see. When he assumes these two poses, he just literally takes over the whole stage. For his deltoids, all I saw him do that day was seated press behind the neck and seated alternate dumbbell forward raise. Using very moderate weights for a man of his immense strength, Sergio did rep after rep of these two exercises nonstop for about 8 total compound sets. On the press behind the neck, he used a fairly wide grip on the bar, and he used deep concentration to thoroughly stimulate those amazing delts. I was really surprised to see him do so many reps for the for his shoulders, because I'm sure he did at least 20 reps each set. When he couldn't do another rep in good style on the press behind the neck, Sergio rested a couple minutes before going to the next part of his compound set, which was the seated alternate dumbbell forward raise. This exercise was performed in a very strict style, and once again, he did at least 20 reps a set, if not more. Sergio finished off his workout with one of his favorite exercises, parallel bar dips. On this exercise, he lowered himself fairly low between the bars, and in no time at all, he completed a rather fast 6 sets of 20 to 25 reps using only his body weight. After the workout was over, Sergio declared to Nubre, "Hey, man, I want to eat." So Nubre arranged for a French-English interpreter to take us to a small bistro. On the way there, I asked Sergio how he felt about the fact that Arnold Schwarzenegger had been the one who had gained the most wealth, fame, and popularity from bodybuilding, when in fact it probably could have been him. "Yes, I think about these things. Maybe the guy was smarter, but I sure don't hold any grudges against the guy. He sure made a lot of money out of this game. You got to hand it to him." At the bistro, Sergio declared he wanted something to eat and fast. Unfortunately, during certain times of the day, it appears to be just about impossible to find any good hot food anywhere in Paris. Sergio tried repeatedly to get the young French interpreter to bring him some eggs. "Eggs, man, ain't you heard about the egg?" said Sergio in total disbelief. "Eggs, eggs, I do not understand what you're asking for." "Eggs," replied our interpreter, looking totally confused. "Yeah, eggs, you a scramble them like this." Sergio assumes the scrambled egg pose. "I want 12 scrambled. You understand, 12 scrambled eggs, pronto," orders the great one. "Scrambled eggs 12? What is scrambled eggs?" repeated the Frenchman. "Look, man, cluck, cluck, cluck," replied the now desperate Sergio Oliva, as his arms jump up and down in a pathetic attempt to imitate a hen. "Cluck, cluck, cluck, eggs, man, eggs," clucked Sergio. "Ah, you want ze chicken," cried the Frenchman. Sergio did not share the young Frenchman's enthusiasm. "This is fucking crazy, man. Let me get out of here," was Sergio's answer. Before he could get out of his chair, I said quickly, "Omelette." "Ah, the omelette. You would like the omelette, no?" replied our friend. Yes, replied poor Sergio, who looked now as though he was ready to eat a scabby horse. Pretty soon we were served 2 beautiful French omelettes, and in no time at all, Sergio devoured every last bite. "Panakeka, I want the panakeka," was Sergio's next cry. "Panake, I do not understand," said our poor frustrated friend. "Oh no, not again," I thought. "I want a panakeka. Don't you know what the panakeka is, man?" replied the great man. I could tell by the tone of Sergio's voice that his simmering nervous system was fast approaching boiling point again. "Look, Sergio has to eat plenty of sweet things today so he can have the energy for the contest," I said weakly. "Sweet, sweet," answered the Frenchman, as though he was in an echo chamber. "Yes, yes, sweet. He has to keep his sugar level up," I countered. "Ah, sugar, ah, sucre. You want the sucre," chirped the Frenchman, as though he had just won $1 million. He jumped up from the table excitedly, and he made his way over to the next room. "I reckon we've cracked it this time, Sergio," I said proudly. "Huh, I've had it with this French shit, man. I want to go home and eat," replied Sergio, completely uninterested in any further conversation. I couldn't believe my eyes when our young Frenchman came hurrying back holding a glass bowl as though it was an Olympic torch. "Sucre, sucre," he declared as he dropped the bowl of sugar lumps right in front of Sergio's nose. "You want the sugar? Here is the sugar for you," he said proudly. I will never forget the look on Sergio's face as long as I live, nor will I forget the look on our poor French friend's face as his great big proud smile slowly dropped into a look of confusion and then into downright pure shock. I really did think that Sergio was going to pick up the entire table, including the Frenchman, myself, and the bowl of sugar lumps, only to throw the lot out the window. I obviously wasn't the only one thinking this, because the entire room of Parisians had suddenly stopped what they were doing, and all eyes were now focused on this huge monster in a navy blue tracksuit, and the poor Frenchman whose complexion had now suddenly changed from fresh to white as a sheet. Amazingly, the great Cuban somehow regained his composure and said to our friend, "You come in with me now. I'll give you the sugar." As the two of them left the bistro, I thought, "Christ, he's going to beat the living daylights out of this poor bugger. What should I do?" I thought. All my worries were completely unfounded because after only a couple of minutes, the two returned smiling and apparently the best of friends. The reason for the sudden friendship, of course, lay inside the huge white box held by the great Cuban. Sergio impetuously pulled at the string which surrounded the box while the Frenchman and myself, plus the rest of the people in the bistro, anxiously awaited the grand opening. "Ah, ah," said the great one, smiling for the first time that day, as the contents of the box were now revealed to one and all. Inside the box were eight of the most delicious-looking French cream cakes you could ever imagine. Holding a cake in each hand, Sergio reminded me of a cement mixer as he delightedly stuffed them into his mouth. "Go on, go on, you have a one. They are so good, man," he said, waving the lovely pastry right under my nose. Well, I don't know, Sergio. You got to keep your strength up, you know. We don't want Foxy to get the edge now, do we?" "No, no, no. You will like these, my friend." And he was right. I did like the cream cakes, and it appeared that our French friend felt the same way because he was sitting licking on his lips just at the sight of the two of us scoffing them down. "You like the pancake?" he required. Sergio and I were both suddenly stopped dead in our tracks by this remark. We just looked at each other, and then we couldn't help but burst out laughing. Wow, what a crazy story. The great Sergio. Man, I would have loved to have seen Sergio training and competing back then in 1981. He had to be unbelievable. I saw Sergio pose a few times in Chicago. Just incredible. One of the greatest physiques ever. All right, another Chris Lund article. This one's on Serge Nubre. It's called Watching Serge Nubre Train. This comes from the September 1982 issue of Muscle Mag. Chris was doing a lot of work for Muscle Mag back then, not just photographs, but also articles. He's a good writer. It says, "I had been looking forward to watching Serge Nubre train for such a long time that I was really quite thrilled when we received a phone call from him here at the Muscle Mag office during the early part of fall. Hello, Chris. I'm in California now, but I'll be in Toronto in 2 days' time. If you want to do anything for Bob Kennedy's magazine, I'll be training at Ken Wheeler's Vic Tanney Nautilus Gym." Needless to say, I sure didn't need to be asked twice. And 2 days later, I found myself walking down the steps to Ken's gym. I was told that Serge would be having two workouts today. He would train his legs at about 11 a.m., and then he would return at 6 p.m. to work his shoulders and arms. Just after 11:30 a.m., Serge and his beautiful wife, Jacqueline, arrived with the ever-exuberant Ken Wheeler, and after many friendly greetings were made to the staff, Serge commenced his training, his morning workout. It was really nice to see Serge training hand-in-hand with his wife, Jacqueline. She followed him exercise for exercise and set for set. The first thing they both did was standing side twist, holding a broom across the shoulders. Just before they both started, Serge took his watch off and placed it on a bench in front of him. I started clicking off as many shots as I could while both of them did their nonstop twists. It then occurred to me that perhaps they were going to do this all day, as they both seemed to go on and on and on. I later asked Serge how long he did the twist for, and this is what he said. "Today I did the twist for only half an hour, but before a contest I do them for 1 hour nonstop." Needless to say, although many authorities claim the exercise is absolutely worthless, Serge has one of the trimmest waistlines and most beautiful-looking midsections in the business. Serge and Jackie then decided to work calves. Not really famous for his calf development, Serge spent considerable time and effort in working them into the ground via only two calf exercises, the first of which was the seated calf raise. Sitting on a modern seated calf raise machine, Serge did set after set of the exercise. I didn't count exactly how many sets he did, but it was way over eight. He didn't work to complete exhaustion on each set, but I could tell he was putting a tremendous amount of concentration into every single repetition. At the extended position, he would hold, tense, and contract the calf muscle as hard as he possibly could. Without too much rest, Serge went over to the standing calf machine and continued to bomb his calves even more with at least another 8 to 10 sets of about 12 to 15 reps of this exercise. One thing I noticed about the workout was the fact that Serge did not rush from set to set, but trained according to how he felt. After he had finished training his calves, I took the opportunity to ask him a few questions. "I notice you're now taking a short break before going on to your next body part. Why do you do this?" "I do this because I believe you should let the body part rest completely just after you've exercised it. I don't see the point in pumping all that blood into a certain body part just to lose it immediately when you go on to another body part. So I always rest after training a particular muscle group. How did your show go last week in California? Who won? The contest was a real success, and I'm very happy about the way things turned out, even though the show was not advertised too well. Sergio Oliva won, beating Cal Scalak. Sergio must have been looking really great to have beaten Scalak. Yeah, Sergio was in great shape, but so was Scalak. It was a very, very difficult job to choose a winner. Serge then said he wished to work his thighs, and all I saw him do that morning was leg curls for about 8 sets of 12 to 15 reps. After each set of leg curls, Serge did not get up from the bench. He just laid there quietly concentrating and regaining his breath for the next set. I asked Serge if that was all he was going to do for his thighs, and he replied, "Yes, that's all I do for them today. Tomorrow I'll train my frontal thigh muscles." "Oh, so you'll be back here tomorrow for another workout then?" I asked. Serge replied, "No, I'll train them at Joe Gold's gym in California tomorrow afternoon." "But you just came here from California last night," I astonishingly replied. "Yes, but my suitcase is there and I have to go back for it," replied the great one with a grin all over his face. After a shower, Serge declared that he wanted to eat some chicken and lots of it. So saying he would be back at 6 p.m. for a second workout, the Nubres departed. I returned to the gym at 6 p.m. promptly, and about a half hour later, Serge and Jacqueline strolled into the gym floor once more. After about another 30 minutes of standing twists with a broom held across their shoulders, they both went over to the universal bench pressing machine and literally did set after set of lying leg raises holding onto the bench press handle. They alternated set for set as one of them did the exercise, the other sat on the bench close by quietly counting the reps out in French. After at least 8 sets of this, they both did numerous sets of sit-ups lying flat on the floor with their knees well bent. A short rest, and Serge said he wanted to train his shoulders. Placing 2 towels on the floor, Serge and Jacqueline lay on their sides and commenced the Nubres favorite for lateral or side deltoid development, the lying dumbbell lateral raise. Lying on his right side, Serge held a light dumbbell in his left hand, and with his left elbow slightly unlocked, raised the dumbbell up until his arm was almost vertical to the ground. It was during the course of this exercise that I began to see the sense in the Nubres system of training. Although Serge did literally set after set of this exercise with only a very light dumbbell for at least half an hour, it became more and more obvious that he was slowly creating more and more intensity into each succeeding set. By doing many, many more sets with a tremendous concentration, he was able to make his deltoids work to their limit. He explained it to me like this. On the first set, I do 15 reps. And on each set afterwards, I force myself to add 1 rep each set. So the muscle gets more and more intensive work each set. Next on the agenda was seated press behind the neck using a shoulder width grip. By tiring the deltoid cap and now going to a compound exercise, Serge is employing the pre-exhaust technique. I had heard many reports that Serge Nubres did his presses behind the neck with only 80 pounds on the bar, but these reports were incorrect because he used only 70 pounds. In fact, Serge Nubres broke every heavy-duty rule in the book. As before, Serge performed literally set after set of the exercise for at least 10 sets. The reps were done much faster than anything I'd seen him do before, and he did them nonstop without a lockout. Serge's final shoulder exercise was standing upright rows with his hands touching each other. He pulled the bar up to his chin, and then he lowered it to his thighs. After his customary 8 to 10 sets of this exercise, he said he wanted to rest before hitting his arms. So once again, I took the chance to ask him a few questions. "Would this be your normal shoulder routine, Serge?" "Yes, more or less. I work much harder before a contest, but these are the 3 exercises I always include in my own shoulder routines. Sometimes I start out with press behind the neck, and sometimes I start with the laterals, like tonight." "Did you ever train on the Nautilus machine, Serge?" "No, I don't, and I don't think I ever will. I like barbells and dumbbells best." Amazingly, Serge did only 1 bicep exercise and 1 tricep exercise for his arms. For triceps, he did the one-arm dumbbell concentration curls. For biceps, he did one-arm concentration curls, supersetted with lying tricep extensions. The curls were done exactly the way everyone else does them, but the tricep extensions were done with a straight bar, lowering the weight onto the bench behind his head. It was amazing how much Serge's arms blew up from using only these 2 exercises. In fact, it was also amazing that Serge could get so much out of a workout using only a very basic set of barbells and dumbbells. So much for all the fancy, sophisticated exercise machines we think we must have to make gains. When he had pumped up his biceps and triceps to their limits, Serge stated his workout was over. And before he left the floor, Ken Wheeler asked him to try a few sets of preacher curls to see if we could get a really good shot of his arms. Serge's arms, especially his triceps, are so big and thick that he had little trouble at first keeping them onto the bench. What seemed amazing before now became unbelievable as the huge, shapely muscle mass began contracting under the weight right before my eyes. Serge Nabre really is one of the greatest physiques today and of all time. After the workout, Ken took Serge, Jacqueline, Bob Kennedy, and myself out for a great meal. Serge admitted to me that he found it extremely difficult to keep in razor-sharp condition year-round. People really expect me to look cut up all the time, and it's really very hard at times because I really do love to eat. I will not, however, accept any exhibition or seminar unless I can have at least 6 weeks preparation, he told me. What did Serge have to eat? Well, he started with a large dish of fresh lobster and crab, followed by a really large piece of steak and a few vegetables. When dessert time came around, Ken tried repeatedly to talk Serge into having the restaurant specialty, which was a beautiful dish of cooked apples smothered in fresh cream. Serge continued to decline, and even when Ken took a chance and ordered the dish, Serge smartly shoved it to one side without even looking at it. I was amazed at such willpower, and I wasted no time at all in devouring the delicious but unwanted high-calorie delight. The end. All right, and one more Chris Lund article. This is about Albert Beckles. It says, Albert Beckles has come into his own. This is from the November 1982 issue of Muscle Mag International. Albert Beckles, formerly the best physique in Britain, is now at this time of writing the world's number one bodybuilder. Consistency has been the major ingredient in Albert's book these past 12 months, and whereas most of his competitors have remained stagnant or even lost ground, he has been able to steadily improve and improve at a remarkable rate. Here is a dedicated athlete of 44 years of age who has conscientiously worked and worked at his body year in and year out, nonstop, for the past 25 years. When your mind has totally been blown by his incredible display of unbelievable rock-hard density on stage, you begin to realize just what goes into building of such an amazing physique. Dedication, sacrifice, determination, and sheer guts are the adjectives that spring to mind when you view the Albert Beckles physique in top contest shape. When Albert Beckles first started training many years ago, there weren't many real professional contests as we know them today, and a bodybuilder actually making a living from the sport was simply unheard of. In the mid-1960s, Albert, of course, was associated with NABBA, the London-based organization, which at that time was one of the major governing bodies controlling the sport. Albert did quite well during this time, winning the NABBA Mr. Britain in 1970 and 1971. Albert came extremely close when he placed second behind Frank Zane in his height class at the 1970 Amateur Mr. Universe contest. This was the last time Albert entered a NABBA show, even though at the time there was very little place for him to go in England, that is. Being just about the first real British boy to make his defection from NABBA, Albert made a brave, at that time, decision to go over to the IFBB, joining forces with other defectees, namely Rick Wayne, Roy Callender, and Will Sylvester. Because the NABBA organization had such a stronghold over the British bodybuilding scene, very little, if anything, was heard of Albert Beckles during the early half of the 1970s, even though he was still religiously training day in and day out. As the IFBB organization steadily grew and grew, it brought with it more and more professional competitions. Albert's own competitive spirit was released, and he found himself regularly traveling around to all corners of the globe. While always being able to turn up in tip-top condition, Albert could always be sure to give value for money as audiences screamed with delight at the sight of those incredible split-peak bicep muscles and razor-sharp muscular development of those rear deltoid and back muscles. Although these attributes brought sensational responses from the audiences, Albert somehow found himself unable to penetrate the extremely high standard of world-class professional bodybuilding. Things began to change when Albert almost won the 1980 IFBB Professional Mr. Universe ran by Arnold Schwarzenegger in Columbus, Ohio. Because most of the world's top pro bodybuilders had made the decision to boycott this event, the field was wide open for the emergence of a new muscular superstar. Although the title was hotly contested between Wilkosch, Platts, and Birdsong, Albert almost stole the whole show with his new display of amazing muscularity. Placing only fourth at the show, Albert returned to England determined to improve even more. Receiving an invitation only 5 weeks prior to the first ever TV-sponsored professional bodybuilding contest, Albert tried his best to get into reasonable shape. Realizing that 5 weeks wasn't enough time to be at his all-time best, Albert nonetheless made the trip out to Atlantic City, where he placed only sixth. It was while in Santa Monica for the California Grand Prix that I first began to get to know Albert Beckles personally. I'd always wanted to get a close-up shot of that amazing arm, and even more than that, I wanted to do a story on him for readers of this magazine. At this show, he seemed somehow to have totally rebalanced the whole of his physique. His previous muscular condition was now paled in comparison to this incredible display of unbelievable rock-hard muscular density. The splits and striations in his thighs were now totally evident, and above all, he posed with pure, determined charisma, smiling all the time. In my book, Albert was a good winner, and I was most surprised to see him only play fourth. I knew then and there that they weren't ready for him, but his time would come. The 1981 New York Night of the Champions saw Albert coming in at 195 pounds and absolutely ripped to the bone. "Hey, Albert, even your face is ripped," I declared when I first viewed those tightly drawn facial muscles. "I've really put out for this one, Chris, and I don't know if I could have lasted another week on the diet," he quietly and modestly declared. Albert came in second again, much to the surprise and disappointment to many of us there. "What does the guy have to do to win?" was the familiar cry after the New York show. I next saw Albert at Winston Roberts' Montreal Grand Prix held in November, and I wasn't too surprised to hear that he had recently finished third in the British Grand Prix and second at the Belgian one. Boyer beat me in Wales and Belgium because he was that much better than me, but I feel I should win today because I think he's gone off a bit, whereas I've gotten better since last week. You see, the longer I stay on my diet, the better I get. I'll be very disappointed if I lose today, were Albert's words after rounds one and two. Indeed, Albert was in the finest shape of his entire career at this contest. Weighing in at 210 pounds, Albert was a full 15 pounds heavier than his New York appearance only 6 months earlier, and more ripped, too. He was most dejected after the Montreal result, and this is the only time I've ever heard him reveal the slightest grumble after a contest decision. Maintaining this incredible degree of muscular condition, Albert went into the February 1982 TV Professional World Cup determined to upset the tables. Looking absolutely huge and ripped, Albert posed with class and polish, taking the title plus $10,000 from Boyer Co. by a clear 9 points to the delight of the packed theater. Knowing only full well how the true hardcore bodybuilding trainee continually cries out for true and accurate, no bullshit information on just exactly how our top champs train and diet, I sat down with Albert and recorded the following interview for readers of this magazine. Along with Roy Callender's 1981 Olympia condition, you must surely be the most muscular bodybuilder in the world at the moment. Your skin is absolutely paper thin. I just couldn't believe my eyes when I saw you stripped backstage. Just what have you been living on to get so ripped? Lately, I've been surviving on only tuna fish, fresh natural pineapple, white fish, and a little turkey. I cut out the chicken because I found it was carrying too much oil. All right, Al, how did you set up each meal? I ate 3 meals a day. For breakfast, I had half a fresh grapefruit, 2 scrambled eggs, no tea or coffee. Midday, I had a pound of grilled white fish and 3 scrambled eggs, nothing more. At night, I had a little turkey and some runner beans and nothing more. How long can you stay on such a diet, Al? 7 weeks is about all I can take. I started the diet about 5 weeks prior to the Belgium Grand Prix, and I stayed on it right through the British Grand Prix and Montreal Grand Prix. I feel I just get that little bit better each show, and I peaked out in the best shape of my life at the Montreal show. So in other words, the longer you were on the diet, the more ripped you became. Exactly. It stands to reason that if you remain on the same diet for a longer period of time and you also continually try to train harder and harder, then you'll burn up more calories, which in turn should leave you looking ripped. I noticed before you oiled down that your skin looked so dry, almost like powder. Can you explain this, Albert? Yes, you're right. My skin was so dry because there was absolutely no oil whatsoever in my body. I was simply just skin, bone, and muscle. Apart from the diet, is there anything else you use to get yourself so damn muscular? I feel that the vitamin C from the fresh pineapple helps to remove the oil from the skin. The sugar from the pineapple also prevents the muscle from shrinking too much when you cut your calories. Montreal was surely the best ever shape of your life. Would you agree? Oh, most definitely. That's why I was so disappointed with the result. That's not like you, Al. I've never known you to complain about losing before. Well, the other contest I just took in my stride, but Montreal, well, I'm really cut up about it because I put so much into preparing for it. Is anyone helping you with your contest preparations? Yes. For this one, I brought a chemist in on the job to help me. How did that help you? Well, first of all, to determine my own body chemistry, because as you know, where everyone's body reacts differently to exercise and nutrition. When I was dieting and training by myself, I would always come in looking ripped, but I had to sacrifice a lot of size in doing so. I was ripped last year in New York, but I looked too small and at 195 pounds. Now, since working hand in hand with my chemist, I can come in at 210 pounds and look even more ripped. Do you believe there's one universal type of way to train, Albert? Oh, definitely not. As I said before, everyone is different and one individual responds differently to another. So you would definitely not be tempted to train any other way other than the Al Beckles way. I do the Al Beckles system because the Al Beckles system works for Al Beckles. And how long has the Al Beckles system been in operation? Ha ha ha, too many years, I think. Well, give some idea, Albert. Someone said at least 20 years, but I'm guessing more like 25 years. Am I right? Yes, I would say so. So this is 25 years of bodybuilding dedication. Okay, if you say so, but I don't really feel that age has anything to do with bodybuilding. You're only as old as you look and feel. Okay, Al, well, getting back to how you've been training this past year or so, can you give me some idea as to your training system? Do you, for instance, train heavy, medium, or light? When I'm dieting for contests such as the IFBB Grand Prix, it's impossible for me to train heavy. When I go to the gym feeling really hungry even before I start working out, then I know it's foolish to ask for 410 pounds on the bench press. To get strong, you have to feed the body. Do you resume heavy training after a contest? No, I don't. First of all, I give my body a rest after the severe dieting. Then I continue training fairly light for a while. The muscle tissue is still not ready for heavy weights. And if I did train heavy, I'd probably knock my joints out. How would you train during the off season when you wanted to increase the muscular mass of your muscles? In other words, how do you get bigger? Well, for this, I would change my training system. First, I would start eating differently, which doesn't mean that I would necessarily eat more. I would include foods that contain more natural sugar, carbohydrates. And of course, I would slowly have to increase my poundages over a period of time. How often do you train, Albert? I train 5 days a week. I always get up at 4 a.m. and I train before going to work. This is the best time for me. How do you work out? Well, over the last few years, I've changed my training approach quite a lot. I no longer set myself certain exercises, sets, and reps. I train really according to how I feel. If, for instance, I work my chest on Monday morning, I may, if I feel the need, work it again in the afternoon or the next day. I don't believe what everyone else says about not working a muscle 2 days in a row. I've been working my thighs every day of the week for the last 2 months, and I've made the best gains ever. Well, it seems to me that you've broken just about every established bodybuilding rule in the book. I have, and it paid off. How big are your arms? Right now, my arms are 21 and a quarter inches, and the biggest I ever got them up to was 22 inches. They went right up to 22 inches after the New York show when my body weight zoomed up to 235 pounds. This happened as soon as I returned to eating foods which contain natural sugars such as pineapple and orange, etc. What did you have to eat right after the show last night? Well, I didn't eat exactly what I wanted, but I had steak, rice, bread, and cheese. You seem to have a liking for rice, Al. Yes, I love rice. Most guys from Barbados really enjoy rice. I guess you followed this with your usual 2 gallons of ice cream, huh? Ha ha ha. Just say ice cream, please. Okay, Albert, what advice would you give someone who asked you how he could get bigger arms? Well, even though I pointed out that it's quite possible to work a muscle every day, I would say that as far as I'm concerned, the arms are an exception to this rule. I've tried working my arms every day and they actually shrank from overwork. If you want bigger arms, work them twice a week only. That's my own arm philosophy. Is it best to work both bicep and tricep together, or is it better to work bicep one workout and tricep in another? I always combine bicep and tricep together in superset style. Why? Well, if you do 2 bicep exercises together, such as a barbell curl and a dumbbell curl, the biceps freak out by the time you reach your 3rd superset. On the other hand, if you follow 1 bicep exercise directly with the tricep exercise, then your biceps will recover much sooner and your whole arm will pump a lot better. Do you go right into a tricep exercise immediately following your bicep exercise? Oh, of course, you have to. What's your favorite bicep exercise, Al? Well, strangely enough, my favorite bicep exercise is really a back movement, and that's a reverse grip lat pull down to the chest. I remember seeing a picture of you doing that particular movement in Ironman years ago. Yes, well, as you see, I'm an old-fashioned in my ways, and when I find something that works for me, I stick with it. So how about giving your readers the lowdown on how you actually train your arms? Because I don't believe I've ever seen anything written on how you actually train them, which is a bit ironic, seeing that you probably have the best arms in the business. Well, thank you very much. Okay, my first exercise is the exercise I just mentioned, reverse grip pull-downs to the chest. I do 4 sets of 15 to 20 reps just to warm me up. What grip width do you use for your pull-downs? Oh, fairly close, about 6 inches. Do you work up in weight each set, or does your poundage remain consistent? I like to keep the weight consistent on these pull-downs so I can flush and burn the bicep as much as possible. Do you execute your reps in a slow or fast fashion? I would say I move the bar a bit faster than most. What's next for your arms? I do Scott curls with press downs on the lat machine. On the Scott curls, I like to curl the bar right over my head and behind my neck. This gives me a far superior contraction of the bicep muscle. The push downs for triceps are done first so I can warm up my elbows properly. What's next, Al? I superset incline dumbbell rotating incline curls with lying tricep extensions. Oh yes, I've heard about your dumbbell curling strength. Wayne D'Amelio told me he saw you repping out with 285-pound dumbbells. Is that right? Yes, that's about right. What's the highest you've ever done on that exercise? Oh, I've done 90s for 8 reps. I don't think that's much, though. Bertel Fox can handle that also. That's a hell of a lot of weight, Albert. No wonder you have 22-inch arms. Well, I didn't start out with that poundage. It took me several years to build up to it. When you increase from 35 pounds to 40 pounds, your muscle size should increase as well. By the time you're curling 290-pound dumbbells for 8 reps, you could have 22-inch arms. Do you do anything else for your arms? I finish off the routine with some reverse grip barbell curls, which I find great for the forearms, the outer head of the bicep, and even the deltoids. I superset these with bent-over tricep kickbacks on the lat machine, and that's enough for the arms. How many sets and reps? I never count either, but I would guess it would be 4 or 5 sets of each exercise and 8 to 10 reps. What's your opinion on training to total failure? I personally think that if you freak yourself out too much on an exercise, then you don't feel like training anymore. I reckon that one should feel good throughout the routine. It's great to start out on your routine feeling strong, but it's nice also to finish that routine nice and contented. I don't feel like this after the total failure bit, but that's only me. So how do you know when to conclude a particular set? I finish a set when I feel a deep burning sensation in my muscles. This is a burning feeling rather than just a pump. And I achieve this feeling by resting less than 30 seconds between sets. If I was using the freak out system of total failure, I would have to rest at least 3 minutes in order to recuperate properly. Currently, you are the top physique in the world today after your tremendous win here in Atlantic City. What are your plans for 1982? Well, my next big contest is, of course, the New York Night of the Champions in May, and then, of course, the Olympia. Yes, the Olympia is being held right in your backyard, so to speak. It sure would be fantastic if you could pull this one off in London. Yes, you're right, it would, and I'm going to prepare myself for this one like never before. Well, I'm sure you'll look fantastic, and dedication to bodybuilding has anything to do with it. I would nominate you as the winner here and now. Thank you. Wow, great article. The great Albert Beckles, who is still alive and well, despite all the rumors to his passing away. Every time I talk about Albert on social media, somebody says he died 2 years ago, and I told him that me and Sean Ray just talked to him on the phone not too long ago, so he is still alive and well. So they mentioned Albert's age was 44, which I believe is correct, because this was in 1982, and that would mean he was born in 1938. That was the year Albert was born, because I've looked in several old magazines that I have, and Albert himself, when I interviewed him on my podcast here several years ago, if you look back in the archives on bodybuildinglegendshow.com on our website, you can find that interview, and Albert said that's the year he was born. A lot of people believe Albert was born in 1930, so they think he's in his 90s right now. They think he's 93, 94 years old, but he's not. He's 86 right now, so doing well and still with us, thank God. All right, guys, that's 4 great articles from Chris Lund from the old Muscle Mag International magazine from the early 1980s. I hope you guys enjoyed these look back 40-plus years ago. Albert Beckles, Serge Dubre, Sergio Oliva, and Bertel Fox, 4 great bodybuilders. Some of them are no longer with us, of course, Bertel was in jail for many years for murdering his girlfriend and her mother, and now he is out of jail. I believe he's living back in, I'm not sure where he's living, actually, but I see him on Facebook all the time now. And like I said, Albert is still with us, but Sergio and Serge Dupre, unfortunately, are no longer with us. So rest in peace. But great hearing some old articles and some great stories from those guys. All right, guys, that's all I got for this week's show. Hope you enjoyed it. We will be back next week with another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Until then, stay safe, train hard, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.